The genuine heart of sadness. Imagine that you are sitting naked on the ground, with your bare bottom touching the earth. Since you are not wearing a scarf or hat, you are also exposed to heaven above. You are sandwiched between heaven and earth, a naked man or woman sitting between heaven and earth. Earth is always earth. The earth will let anyone sit on it. And earth never gives way. It never lets you go. You don't drop off this earth and go flying through outer space. Likewise, sky is always sky. Heaven is always heaven above you. Whether it is snowing or raining or the sun is shining, whether it is daytime or nighttime, the sky is always there. In that sense, we know that heaven and earth are trustworthy. The logic of basic goodness is very similar. When we speak of basic goodness, we are not talking about having allegiance to good and rejecting bad. Basic goodness is good because it is unconditional or fundamental. It is there already, in the same way that heaven and earth are there already. We don't reject our atmosphere. We don't reject the sun and the moon, the clouds and the sky. We accept them. We accept that the sky is blue. We accept the landscape and the sea. We accept highways and buildings and cities. Basic goodness is that basic, that unconditional. It is not a for or against view, in the same way that sunlight is not for or against. The natural law and order of this world is not for or against. Fundamentally, there is nothing that either threatens us or promotes our point of view. The four seasons occur free from anyone's demand or vote. Hope and fear cannot alter the seasons. There is day, there is night. There is darkness at night and light during the day. And no one has to turn a switch on and off. There is a natural law and order that allows us to survive and that is basically good. Good in that it is there and it works and it is efficient. We often take for granted this basic law and order in the universe, but we should think twice. We should appreciate what we have. Without it, we would be in a total predicament. If we didn't have sunlight, we wouldn't have any vegetation. We wouldn't have any crops, and we couldn't cook a meal. So basic goodness is good because it is so basic, so fundamental. It is natural and it works, and therefore it is good, rather than being good as opposed to bad. The same principle applies to our makeup as human beings. We have passion, aggression, and ignorance. That is, we cultivate our friends, and we ward off our enemies, and we are occasionally indifferent. Those tendencies are not regarded as shortcomings. They are part of the natural elegance and equipment of human beings. We are equipped with nails and teeth to defend ourselves against attack. We are equipped with a mouth and genitals to relate with others. And we are lucky enough to have complete digestive and respiratory systems so that we can process what we take in and flush it out. Human existence is a natural situation. And like the law and order of the world, it is workable and efficient. In fact, it is wonderful. It is ideal. Some people might say this world is the work of a divine principle, but the Shambhala teachings are not concerned with divine origins. The point of warriorship is to work personally with our situation now, as it is. From the Shambhala point of view, when we say that human beings are basically good, we mean that they have every faculty they need, so they don't have to fight with their world. Our being is good because it is not a fundamental source of aggression or complaint. We cannot complain that we have eyes, ears, a nose, and a mouth. We cannot redesign our physiological system, and for that matter, we cannot redesign our state of mind. Basic goodness is what we have, what we are provided with. It is the natural situation that we have inherited from birth onwards. We should feel that it is wonderful to be in this world. How wonderful it is to see red and yellow, blue and green, purple and black. All of these colors are provided for us. We feel hot and cold. We taste sweet and sour. We have these sensations and we deserve them. They are good. So the first step in realizing basic goodness is to appreciate what we have. But then we should look further and more precisely at what we are, where we are, who we are, when we are, and how we are as human beings, so that we can take possession of our basic goodness. It is not really a possession, but nonetheless, we deserve it. Basic goodness is very closely connected to the idea of bodhicitta in the Buddhist tradition. Bodhi means awake, or wakeful, and citta means heart. So bodhicitta is awakened heart. Such awakened heart comes from being willing to face your state of mind. That may seem like a great demand, but it is necessary. You should examine yourself and ask how many times you have tried to connect with your heart, fully and truly. How often have you turned away, because you feared you might discover something terrible about yourself? How often have you been willing to look at your face in the mirror without being embarrassed? How many times have you tried to shield yourself by reading the newspaper, watching television, or just spacing out? That is the $64,000 question. How much have you connected with yourself at all in your whole life? The sitting practice of meditation is the means to rediscover basic goodness. And beyond that, it is the means to awaken this genuine heart within yourself. When you sit in the posture of meditation, you are exactly the naked man or woman that we described earlier, sitting between heaven and earth. When you slouch, you are trying to hide your heart, trying to protect it by slumping over. But when you sit upright but relaxed in the posture of meditation, your heart is naked. Your entire being is exposed. To yourself, first of all, but to others as well. So through the practice of sitting still and following your breath as it goes out and dissolves, you are connecting with your heart. By simply letting yourself be as you are, you develop genuine sympathy towards yourself. When you awaken your heart in this way, you find, to your surprise, that your heart is empty. You find that you are looking into outer space. What are you? Who are you? Where is your heart? If you really look, you won't find anything tangible and solid. Of course, you might find something very solid if you have a grudge against someone, or you have fallen possessively in love. But that is not awakened heart. If you search for awakened heart, if you put your hand through your ribcage and feel for it, there's nothing there except for tenderness. You feel sore and soft. And if you open your eyes to the rest of the world, you feel tremendous sadness. This kind of sadness doesn't come from being mistreated. You don't feel sad because someone has insulted you or because you feel impoverished. Rather, this experience of sadness is unconditioned. It occurs because your heart is completely exposed. There is no skin or tissue covering it. It is pure, raw meat. Even if a tiny mosquito lands on it, you feel so touched. Your experience is raw and tender and so personal. The genuine heart of sadness comes from feeling that your non-existent heart is full. You would like to spill your heart's blood, give your heart to others. For the warrior, this experience of sad and tender heart is what gives birth to fearlessness. Conventionally, being fearless means that you are not afraid, or that if someone hits you, you will hit him back. However, we are not talking about that street fighter level of fearlessness. Real fearlessness is the product of tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your heart, your raw and beautiful heart. You are willing to open up without resistance or shyness and face the world. You are willing to share your heart with others. Fear and fearlessness. In order to experience fearlessness, it is necessary to experience fear. The essence of cowardice is not acknowledging the reality of fear. Fear can take many forms. Logically, we know we can't live forever. We know that we are going to die, so we are afraid. We are petrified of our death. On another level, we are afraid that we can't handle the demands of the world. This fear expresses itself as a feeling of inadequacy. We feel that our own lives are overwhelming, and confronting the rest of the world is more overwhelming. Then there is abrupt fear, or panic, that arises when new situations occur suddenly in our lives. When we feel that we can't handle them, we jump or twitch. Sometimes fear manifests in the form of restlessness, doodles on a notepad, playing with our fingers, or fidgeting in our chairs. We feel that we have to keep ourselves moving all the time, like an engine running in a motor car. The pistons go up and down, up and down. As long as the pistons keep moving, we feel safe. Otherwise, we are afraid we might die on the spot. There are innumerable strategies that we use to take our minds off of fear. Some people take tranquilizers. Some people do yoga. Some people watch television, or read a magazine, or go to a bar to have a beer. From the coward's point of view, boredom should be avoided, because when we are bored, we begin to feel anxious. We are getting closer to our fear. Entertainment should be promoted, and any thought of death should be avoided. So cowardice is trying to live our lives as though death were unknown. There have been periods in history in which many people searched for a potion of longevity. If there were such a thing, most people would find it quite horrific. If they had to live in this world for 1,000 years without dying, long before they got to their 1,000th birthday, they would probably commit suicide. Even if you could live forever, you would be unable to avoid the reality of death and suffering around you. Fear has to be acknowledged. We have to realize our fear and reconcile ourselves with fear. We should look at how we move, how we talk, how we conduct ourselves, how we chew our nails, how we sometimes put our hands in our pockets uselessly. Then we will find something out about how fear is expressed in the form of restlessness. We must face the fact that fear is lurking in our lives, always, in everything we do. On the other hand, acknowledging fear is not a cause for depression or discouragement. Because we possess such fear, we also are potentially entitled to experience fearlessness. True fearlessness is not the reduction of fear, but going beyond fear. Unfortunately, in the English language, we don't have a word that means that. Fearlessness is the closest term, but by fearless, we don't mean less fear, but beyond fear. Going beyond fear begins when we examine our fear, our anxiety, nervousness, concern, and restlessness. If we look into our fear, if we look beneath its veneer, The first thing we find is sadness beneath the nervousness. Nervousness is cranking up, vibrating all the time. When we slow down, when we relax with our fear, we find sadness, which is calm and gentle. Sadness hits you in your heart, and your body produces a tear. Before you cry, there is a feeling in your chest, and then, after that, you produce tears in your eyes. You are about to produce rain or waterfall in your eyes, and you feel sad and lonely, and perhaps romantic at the same time. That is the first tip of fearlessness, and the first sign of real warriorship. You might think that when you experience fearlessness, you will hear the opening to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, or see a great explosion in the sky. But it doesn't happen that way. In the Shambhala tradition, discovering fearlessness comes from working with the softness of the human heart. The birth of the warrior is like the first growth of a reindeer's horns. At first, the horns are very soft and almost rubbery, and they have little hairs growing on them. They are not yet horns as such. They are just sloppy growths with blood inside. Then, as the reindeer ages, the horns grow stronger, developing 4 points or 10 points or even 40 points. Fearlessness at the beginning is like those rubbery horns. They look like horns, but you can't quite fight with them. When a reindeer first grows its horns, it doesn't know what to use them for. It must feel very awkward to have those soft, lumpy growths on your head. But then the reindeer begins to realize that it should have horns, that horns are a natural part of being a reindeer. In the same way, when a human being first gives birth to the tender heart of warriorship, he or she may feel extremely awkward or uncertain about how to relate to this kind of fearlessness. But then, as you experience this sadness more and more, you realize that human beings should be tender and open. So you no longer need to feel shy or embarrassed about being gentle. In fact, your softness begins to become passionate. You would like to extend yourself to others and communicate with them. When tenderness evolves in that direction, then you can truly appreciate the world around you. Sense perceptions become very interesting things. You are so tender and open already that you cannot help opening yourself to what takes place all around you. When you see red or green or yellow or black, you respond to them from the bottom of your heart. When you see someone else crying or laughing or being afraid, you respond to them as well. At that point, your beginning level of fearlessness is developing further into warriorship. When you begin to feel comfortable being a gentle and decent person, your reindeer horns no longer have little hairs growing on them. They are becoming real horns. Situations become very real, quite real, and, on the other hand, quite ordinary. Fear evolves into fearlessness naturally, very simply, and quite straightforwardly. The ideal of warriorship is that the warrior should be sad and tender, and because of that, the warrior can be very brave as well. Without that heartfelt sadness, bravery is brittle, like a china cup. If you drop it, it will break or chip. But the bravery of the warrior is like a lacquer cup, which has a wooden base covered with layers of lacquer. If the cup drops, it will bounce rather than break. It is soft and hard at the same time. Letting go. The result of practicing the discipline of warriorship is that you learn to stop ambition and frivolity, and out of that, you develop a good sense of balance. Balance comes not from holding on to a situation, but from making friends with heaven and earth. Earth is gravity, or practicality. Heaven is vision or the experience of open space in which you can uplift your posture, your head and shoulders. Balance comes from joining practicality with vision, or we could say, joining skill with spontaneity. First, you must trust in yourself. Then you can also trust in the earth or gravity of a situation, and because of that, you can uplift yourself. At that point, your discipline becomes delightful rather than being an ordeal or a great demand. When you ride a horse, balance comes not from freezing your legs to the saddle, but from learning to float with the movement of the horse as you ride. Each step is a dance, the rider's dance as well as the dance of the horse. When discipline begins to be natural, a part of you, it is very important to learn to let go. For the warrior, letting go is connected with relaxing within discipline in order to experience freedom. Freedom here does not mean being wild or sloppy. Rather, it is letting yourself go so that you fully experience your existence as a human being. Letting go is completely conquering the idea that discipline is a punishment for a mistake or a bad deed that you have committed or might like to commit. You have to completely conquer the feeling that there is something fundamentally wrong with your human nature and that therefore you need discipline to correct your behavior. As long as you feel that discipline comes from outside, there is still a lingering feeling that something is lacking in you. So letting go is connected with letting go of any vestiges of doubt or hesitation or embarrassment about being you as you are. You have to relax with yourself in order to fully realize that discipline is simply the expression of your basic goodness. You have to appreciate yourself, respect yourself, and let go of your doubt and embarrassment so that you can proclaim your goodness and basic sanity for the benefit of others. In order to let go, first you have to train yourself in the discipline of renunciation, as well as the other aspects of discipline that we have already discussed. This is necessary so that you will not confuse letting go with aggression or arrogance. Without proper training, letting go can be confused with pushing yourself to the breaking point in order to prove to yourself that you are a brave and fearless person. This is too aggressive. Letting go also has nothing to do with enjoying yourself at other people's expense by promoting your own ego and laying your trips on others. Arrogance of that kind is not really based on letting go in any case. It is based on a fundamental insecurity about yourself, which makes you insensitive rather than soft and gentle. For example, a professional driver in an auto race can drive at 200 miles an hour on the racetrack because of his training. He knows the limits of the engine and the steering and the tires. He knows the weight of the car, the road conditions, and the weather conditions. So he can drive fast without it becoming suicidal. Instead, it becomes a dance. But if you play with letting go before you have established a proper connection with discipline, then it is quite dangerous. If you are learning to ski and you try to let go and relax at an early level of your athletic training, you might easily fracture a bone. So if you mimic letting go, you may run into trouble. You might think that based on this discussion, you will never have sufficient training to let go and relax in your discipline. You might feel that you will never be ready to be a daring person. But once you have made a basic connection to discipline, it is time to let go of those doubts. If you are waiting for your discipline to become immaculate, that time will never come unless you let go. When you begin to enjoy the discipline of warriorship, when it begins to feel natural, even though it may still feel very imperfect, that is the time to let go. Obviously, letting go is more than just relaxation. It is relaxation based on being in tune with the environment, the world. One of the important principles of letting go is living in the challenge. But this does not mean living with a constant crisis. For example, Suppose your banker calls and says that your account is overdrawn, and the same day your landlord tells you that you are about to be evicted for failing to pay your rent. To respond to this crisis, you get on the telephone and call all your friends to see if you can borrow enough money to avert the crisis. Living in the challenge is not based on responding to demands that you have created for yourself by failing to relate to the details of your life. For the warrior, every moment is a challenge to be genuine, and each challenge is delightful. When you let go properly, you can relax and enjoy the challenge. The setting sun version of letting go is to take a vacation, or to get drunk and become wild and sloppy, and do outrageous things that in your right mind you would never contemplate. The Shambhala understanding is obviously quite different. For the warrior, letting go is not based on getting away from the constraints of ordinary life. It is quite the opposite. It is going further into your life because you understand that your life, as it is, contains the means to unconditionally cheer you up and cure you of depression and doubt. The setting sun understanding of cheering up is talking yourself into feeling better, rather than actually cheering up. When you wake up in the morning and get out of bed, you go into the bathroom and look at yourself in the mirror. Your hair is somewhat disheveled, you are half asleep, and there are bags under your eyes. In the setting sun world, you say to yourself with a big sigh, "Here we go again." You feel that you have to crank yourself up to get through the day. To use another example, when the Iranian revolutionaries were guarding the hostages at the American embassy, they probably woke up in the morning with a feeling of delight. "Great, we have hostages next door." That is a setting sun version of cheerfulness. Cheering up is not based on artificial willpower or creating an enemy and conquering him in order to make yourself feel more alive. Human beings have basic goodness, not next door, but in them already. When you look at yourself in the mirror, you can appreciate what you see, without worrying about whether what you see is what should be. You can pick up on the possibilities of basic goodness and cheer yourself up, if you just relax with yourself. Getting out of bed, walking into the bathroom, taking a shower, eating breakfast, you can appreciate whatever you do, without always worrying whether it fits your discipline or your plan for the day. You can have that much trust in yourself, and that will allow you to practice discipline much more thoroughly than if you constantly worry and try to check back to see how you are doing. You can appreciate your life, even if it is an imperfect situation. Perhaps your apartment has run down, and your furniture is old and inexpensive. You do not have to live in a palace. You can relax and let go wherever you are. Wherever you are, it is a palace. If you move into an apartment that was left in a mess, you can spend the time to clean it up, not because you feel bad or oppressed by dirt, but because you feel good. If you take the time to clean up and move in properly, you can transform a dumpy apartment into an accommodating home. Human dignity is not based on monetary wealth. Affluent people may spend a great deal of money making their homes luxurious, but they may be creating artificial luxury. Dignity comes from using your inherent human resources by doing things with your own bare hands, on the spot, properly and beautifully. You can do that. Even in the worst of the worst situations, you can still make your life elegant. Your body is an extension of basic goodness. It is the closest implement or tool that you have to express basic goodness, so appreciating your body is very important. The food you eat, the liquor you drink, the clothes you wear, and getting proper exercise are all important. You don't have to jog or do push-ups every day, but it is important to take an attitude of caring about your body. Even if you have a physical handicap, you don't have to feel that you are imprisoned by it. You can still respect your body and your life. Your dignity extends beyond your handicap. In the name of heaven and earth, you can afford to make love to yourself.